Okay, and then Leo was doing the vacuum polarization, which I appreciate very much. And so, your starting calculation was evaluating this graph in quantum electrodynamics, but not quite evaluating this graph because we're not actually evaluating the external lines. And I know that nobody complained, but I don't know how explicitly the factors of the Feynman rules, you were following the factors of the Feynman rules. So he had an expression which, the starting point was, I want to just fill in the line that gets us to the starting point here. What's the best thing to do here? So there's two questions. One of them is why are we doing the Feynman rules without the external lines? And are you happy with the normalizations and the factors of I and the twos and the symmetry factors that would have gone into evaluating a graph like this? Because it's no different than it would have been for a tree graph. But it's you want to make sure that you're completely happy with the Feynman rules. And so, so the first part of it is probably, as far as the Feynman rules go, I'm at a point where I there's a various places here where we could spin off and we could talk about topics. And when we get to the handling the divergences that we're about to talk about, there'll be a natural time to start talking about renormalization and divergences in general. And there's a similar issue here when it comes time to discuss the Feynman rules about the actual quantization of quantum electrodynamics, which I've kind of didn't really do in detail, partly because everybody said that they've seen it. And so when there's two ways to quantize quantum electrodynamics. And the old school party line way to do it would be to canonically quantize like you would quantize any field theory, treat it like a classical field theory, identify its canonical momentum, impose the canonical commutation relations where the momenta and the positions in the fields, commute up to factors of H bar, and that's the way in which you would infer the creation and annihilation operator algebra for the when you expand the fields in terms of creation and annihilation operators. And that's a subtle business in quantum electrodynamics. And so what I'm not sure, it's worth doing it once just so you never do it again. And so what I'm having a hard time getting a reading on is whether or not you guys have seen how ugly that is and have, so what people do normally is that they, if you do this quantization canonically for quantum electrodynamics, you see that the interaction Hamiltonian is not, you might have thought it was going to be something covariant like the minus the Lagrangian. You might have thought it was going to be something like the current times the gauge field or something would be the interaction term, and so that's looks like a Lorentz scalar. So, since we took our Lagrangian in quantum mechanics is we have minus psi bar partial slash plus m psi minus 1/2 f mu, and then if this had been a covariant derivative, that adds the interaction term here. So if you call that kind of J mu, A mu, do you mind if I close that door here? I'm finding it very annoying. You might have thought that the Lagrangian looks like it's got an interaction piece which is nice and covariant. So you might have thought that the Hamiltonian, the interaction, if you call this kind of the free part, and call this the interaction part, you might have thought that the Hamiltonian, if you wrote the Hamiltonian in a similar way, that it would have a free part and an interaction part. And you might have thought that this would be basically minus this or something similarly covariant. And that's not what happens, right? What happens when you do this is that the first thing you see is that when you calculate the momenta, there's constraints that relate the positions and momentum of the field, so that the quantization has to change from the standard one anyway because it's a constrained system. But when you sort through all that, the next thing you see is that this thing has got a piece which looks like minus this, but there's also then the Coulomb interaction, which is an explicitly non-covariant piece. And if you kind of ask why are scattering processes Lorentz invariant in this theory, there's a miraculous cancellation between the failure of this to be covariant and the, you know, the propagator. If you calculate the propagator a mu x, a nu y, the time-ordered correlation function, this thing is actually also not covariant, but there's a Seagull term or something which is you know, explicitly not covariant. And there's a cancellation of the failure of this to be covariant with the failure of this to be covariant in a way it looks like it's a miracle. And because of that, people never do this. They always do path integral quantization. So, and that's kind of why you do path integral quantization, is that if you just do the operator thing, it just hurts so much. And so, and then the path integral story is just that you're in the end of the day, for a path integral, you start off, you show that your transition amplitudes that you're interested in, whatever you're trying to calculate, is some integral over the fields, e to the I action. And so if you write the action as being the quadratic part is the non-interacting piece, and then the non-quadratic part is the interacting piece, then if you Taylor expand this part, the exponential to be 1, you know, so if you take e to the I s interaction as being 1 plus I s interaction plus, you know, 1 half I squared s interaction squared. Then you're just doing Gaussian integrals everywhere, and then things are quadratic here, and then you've got polynomials of fields here, and Gaussian integrals you can do, and they involve the inverses of the quadratic part of the action, and that's the propagators, and this way of doing it, every step along the way things are covariant because, you know, the action is integral of Lagrangian. The Lagrangian was constructed to be a Lorentz scalar. And so the Feynman rules and all the perturbative story are really easy to express in terms of a path integral. And I don't know how explicit I should make this, because I'm not sure if this is a story you've seen before. It's one of these things that it's seeing it once you've seen it once, you never do this canonical thing anymore. And so you don't need to, it's one of those things that it's worth having someone do that for you once in your life so you never have to do it again. Or you could just be happy to take for granted that you know, you'll never look at this. But there is a story that about why path integrals are easier than the canonical picture. So when I first asked people about canonical quantization and QED and about path integrals, they all said they'd seen it. Everybody here said they'd seen it. So, and I know that there are some people who have since afterwards said not, that they would actually prefer to see path integrals in particular done. And so what I'm not getting a sense of or what I like to get a sense of is to what extent path integrals are, for most of you, something which, you know, the setup of the path integral, is it a useful thing to go through for everybody? So, how about you and Guelph? I can't see you because all I can see is the screen there.
So we haven't used it that much. We did the canonical quantization of the electromagnetic field instead.
But you have seen the canonical quantization.
Yeah, we did that in full.
Okay, so you've done the suffering part. So this would be the easier part. Okay. Okay, so what I'll do is I'll come back to that later on then, and we'll squeeze this in somewhere. But probably now we're in the middle of this vacuum polarization calculation is not the place to do it. But what I will do is I will what I'd like to do is for that Feynman graph, just motivate the Feynman rules. And I'll just take them as if we're talking about doing path integrals. And I'll come back to justify that in more detail. But the main thing I want to follow for the purposes of this Feynman graph story now is these factors of I that are coming along from e to the I action. Effectively, you know, if you do the Gaussian integral, if you had a finite dimensional Gaussian integral, e to the, say, there's part of the path integral story is do you do integrals in Minkowski signature or you do them in Euclidean signature? And that's really the issue of, can you do the integral e to the minus 1/2 x transpose matrix x? That integral converges, but could we have done the integral, you know, with a factor of I here? Would that integral have converged as a, made sense as a Gaussian integral? And I don't know what, normally the people tell you all sorts of lies about this, but it's, the statement is that if you have only one variable, if you had integral dx of e to the minus I over 2, you know, a x squared, that integral converges. You could throw that on a computer and it would tell you what it is. And one way to see that is if you took x squared and you defined u to be x squared, maybe 1/2, u to be 1/2 x squared, then this would be integral of, so dx, I guess du would be x dx. So dx would be du over x, which is square root of 2u e to the I. AU minus IAU. This integral converges absolutely because if you take the absolute value here, the 1 over the square root of u, if we did this from minus infinity to infinity, would make it converge. And so you can actually put this on a computer and get an answer. And it's what you would have had in the real case up plus a phase. And the way the easiest way to evaluate it would be in the complex plane, if you're integrating like that, is to rotate it using the x variables, rotate it halfway up like that. And instead of doing this integral, you do this integral. And in that, once you've rotated like that, then the integral you end up doing is the one where it's essentially the real one. So there's no bonus in doing the real versus the complex integral if there's only one of these integrals. The difference between the phase and the real integral comes when you're doing n of these integrals, because if you have, there's two ways to think about this integral in the real case. If this had been a 1, then you can think of this integral as being an integral where you're just actually, if you diagonalize this matrix, it's just a one-dimensional integral done many times. And so it's the iteration of a one-dimensional integral. Another way of thinking about it is as an area integral, where you're integrating over, you could think in terms of the radial variable and the angles, let's say. And those two things are the same if it's an absolutely convergent integral. So they're the same here. But if we had a phase here, what would happen is that the thinking of this as being the iteration of an of the integral dx1 multiplied by the integral dx2 and being the product of a whole bunch of one-dimensional integrals still makes sense. But if you tried to think of this as an area integral, then this same argument would fail because you'd have this dnx would have powers of u in front of it. And so you can't think of this thing as an area integral usefully. And so when you're thinking of a path integral, which is like an infinite dimensional version of the whole story, there's an issue to be thought through here. But the bottom line is if you're doing Gaussian integrals, then effectively you can treat it as if these things are Gaussian with a Euclidean signature for the examples we're going to do. And so when I do the path integral story, I'll make this more precise and so that you'll really see what's going on. But in practice, all you really need to know now for the Feynman rules is that the way you do Gaussian integrals is that it's morally as if they're Euclidean. And this thing, if we were doing an integral of the form, you know, xi, xj, xk, if we're thinking x as being a column vector, then if we have an odd number of x's, then this would have been 0 because the integral for integrating from minus infinity to infinity would be an odd not under reflection, but integrated over an even range. So that would be equal to zero if there are, say, if we have n factors here. If n equals odd. And if n is even, then all we're doing is it would be equal to, there's a factor of the determinant of a to the minus 1/2. And then there's all possible ways of combining a inverse to make these match these indices up. So a inverse, you know, ij, a inverse, kl, and so on, and all possible pairings, plus the permutations. All possible ways to kind of link these various indices with inverses of this matrix A. And the bottom line there is that's what Feynman rules are, is basically you've got all possible ways of connecting external lines. The lines are describing these indices, and the propagators are these inverse matrices, and they came to you as the inverse of the thing in the quadratic part of the Lagrangian, and blah, 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 blah. This determinant, you're probably used to, because if we had a one-dimensional integral e to the minus 1/2 ax squared minus infinity, we would have gotten square root of, you know, what would it be? It would be 2 pi over a or something like that. So if we have many of these things, if you diagonalize the matrix, then you're going to get products of this for the eigenvalues, and then that's the thing that becomes the determinant. And here I'm assuming that we're doing an integral over a bosonic variable. If we've been doing it over a fermionic variable, there's a similar story, but we would have had determinant plus 1/2, and that's something which I'll come back to when we do the path integral story. But so that means for the purposes of the exercise of the Feynman rules, all you really need to keep track of is where the factors of I come from. So you see that there's an I for each vertex, and there's a factor of I, 1 over I, coming when you take the inverse of a matrix to get a propagator. And there's combinatorial factors coming from expanding the exponential. You know, if we take the nth term involving n factors of an interaction, there's going to be an n factorial from expanding the exponential. And then there's kind of symmetry factors coming from keeping track of how many ways you can combine the given external lines to get what you're looking for. And so I told you that story really just to tell you this story. And so we were calculating this. And the thing we actually wrote would have been, so what you would have said here is that there would be a propagator here, which I'll write temporarily for a second. So we would have had there's a 1 over I. So there's this I, I get an inverse of I for a propagator. And in the convention that I'm using, there's a 2 pi to the fourth. When we go to momentum space, the integral, the space position integrals become momentum integrals. And those you get those in the denominator for the propagators. And then we have what do we call it? G mu nu with momentum P. So we have momentum P coming in. P prime, what do we call this one? Call this L. This would have to be L minus P prime or something. So we have a vertex here. And the vertex comes with the factor of I, because that's this I. There's a 2 pi to the fourth coming from going position space to momentum space. There's a delta function at that vertex, which is P minus P coming in. I took that bigger in that way. So there's a P plus L minus P prime minus P prime minus L, I guess. Right. Oh, I guess what I've done is I've actually solved this already. So let's just write this as K. That's P plus K minus L. So I'm thinking K flowing that way. And then there's some vertex, which is got E's and gamma mu's in it. And then and we have the fermion loop, which was a trace. So let me put that. put the E gamma mu here. And we have the propagator, which we can work along backwards. We had some propagator, which depends on K, fermion of propagator. We have another vertex here, which will have an E gamma nu. Keep track of my things here. That's a mu nu. We'll have, say, gamma alpha, another propagator with momentum L. So here we follow the Dirac indices around that line. There's a 2 pi to the fourth for the second vertex that I didn't write yet. And a delta function for it, which would be L coming in, K and P going out. What else? Now we have two interactions here. So in this exponential e to the I something, we're at a point here where we're following this thing. So there's a factor of two coming from the, this is the 1/2 factorial coming from the exponential. And then there's a symmetry factor where we, so we, you know, what we had was we had an external, I haven't finished writing the factors yet. I haven't written this propagator factor yet, which is the analog of this, right? So I have a minus I over 2 pi to the fourth times G alpha, say gamma, P prime. And I also didn't write the minus I. These propagators here would have had also a factor of minus I over 2 pi to the fourth for each of those. So that's for that propagator and that propagator. Now we had also, so we had a, if we take the things, the ingredients of our graph, we had a fermion. We had two vertices with fermions, and we had two external lines with gauge bosons. And so we have to ask how many ways could we connect them up, because that's the story of how many ways can we connect up the indices with this matrices. So because the fermion, so the arrows in the fermion line are expressing that there's a conserved charge that the fermion carries because it was electrically charged. So we had psi bar and psi, for example. So the thing that's destroyed by psi is not the same thing that's destroyed by psi bar, because particles and antiparticles are different for that. So that means that that the particle that's being produced, say here, can only be destroyed by this one. Can't be destroyed by this field. And so that means there's only one way to connect this line up to get a circle. So there's no options as to how we connected the fermions up to get the graph that we're looking at. And then we had the choice of these two gauge fields could have connected that way or that way, and that would have been equally good. So there's a factor of two coming from those two ways that are give you equivalent graphs. And then there's overall minus sign because we have a fermion loop. And so those are all the factors, I think, right? Those are, if you went through all the Feynman rules, those are the things that you would keep track of. And that's kind of representative of how you would do this for any graph. And so you see a lot of them are going to go away for free. So we end up with, so the two cancels the 2 factorial. We've got a minus I. I want to keep track of these two factors of the gauge boson propagators separately because we're not interested in them so much. And I'll come back to why in a second. But I'll write them separately here. An overall minus sign from that statistics one. We have G mu nu of P. That was one factor corresponding to this external line. In the other external line, we have the minus I over 2 pi to the fourth G, what do I call alpha gamma. And then we had a whole bunch of we have 1, 2, 3, 4. Excuse me. So in principle, if we follow these I to the pi to the fourth, we had one here, and we had two factors of these from the fermion and propagator. So those would have canceled out. We wouldn't have to write them. And if we looked at the delta functions, we should also be integrating over all these momenta, right? Then we should be integrating over all the momenta that we haven't. Like L should be integrated over, K should be integrated over. And those integrals will do some of these delta functions. And So I should probably write that somewhere. There's an integral e4l. Integral. Okay. But you see that they don't actually do both these. These delta functions don't do both those integrals, because what will happen is that one of these delta functions does one of these integrals. But once we're done, once we've done that, then the remaining delta function is going to express the overall delta function that this thing had to satisfy. That there's a delta p has to be equal to p prime. So if we do this right, you should see that if we use if we do the k integral with this delta function, then we learn that k is equal to l minus p. And so this thing becomes delta of l minus p prime minus k, which is minus l plus p. And so you see the l's drop out, and we get delta of p minus p prime. And that's the delta function that expresses that momentum had to be conserved through the whole graph. So the second integral doesn't get done by the delta function. It has to be done as an honest integral. So we have, so let me keep track of this overall delta function, p minus p prime. And let me write a conventional factor of I, 2 pi to the fourth, in front of that. Because this is part of the definition of the vacuum polarization. And then what's left is what we've been writing down here. So we have an integral d4l. And because I've written in a factor of I 2 pi to the fourth, I have to divide by one now. I 2 pi to the fourth. And then all these other things that I've been writing here. So there's, I guess, the trace of these indices nu and alpha. So what we call the vacuum polarization pi mu nu is this. Everything from here on. So there's a conventional factor of 2 pi to the fourth that's pulled out, and there's a conventional factor of the delta function. This minus sign, I guess, would also, I should write it in there. But it doesn't have the external lines written down, and it's just that's just a definition. So that's kind of the thing we've been evaluating. Yeah. These are the propagators here, though, right? When you make a graph, the things that are going to play the role of these internal lines that I'm talking about they're really these things here. And the vertices. So when you're combining if these X's had appeared, these are really the fields. If they'd come to you as things that were in the interaction Lagrangian, because these are ultimately polynomials of the fields. When you Taylor expand them out like this and write them in terms of fields, you're getting powers of the fields. And those, when the indices that these propagators are carrying are the ones that would correspond to the vertices. So that would correspond to the propagators that are going from vertex 1 to vertex 2 there would be these kind of matrices. This determinant is there, and it's often, if it doesn't depend on anything, it depends on the calculation you're doing, whether or not you actually care if this factor is there. It depends on the variables you're following. So in this kind of a calculation that we're doing now, this is something that would appear in the one loop contribution, but it's something which is actually in the normalization of the thing we're calculating. It doesn't depend on the momenta, for instance, of the external lines here, and so it's something which is not playing such an important role in the thing we're calculating up there. But when I do the path integral, it'll be clearer how that plays out. But what I'm doing now is I'm following these factors of A inverse, which are the playing the role of the internal lines there. So the bottom line is that what Leo was working out for you was pi mu nu of p was this factor here. So it was minus the integral d4l. And I guess the minus I goes with the minus I to give you an I. Trace of all the stuff that was in that river was up there. So now if I'm going to use labels mu nu, here I was using labels new alpha, so I should just, I'll just relabel that to be gamma mu propagator. E gamma nu propagator. And then he was working that out in detail what that was. And these conventional factors have been pulled out because next thing I want to say is, so why are we defining things in this way? And that is that, you know, what are we calculating here? We're calculating here the correction to a propagator. So you should think of if we were interested in the electromagnetic propagator, it would have a sum of contributions which would come. You know, there'd be a graph like this would be the lowest order contribution, but then there'd be a contribution to it like the one we're calculating. So we label these things by mu and nu, if you like. But there would be, you know, a whole series of graphs like this amongst all the other graphs in the problem would all be contributing to the electromagnetic propagator. And the point of one of the points of the exercise is that later on we'll make more of an exactic statement, but you can kind of see from this particular class that the claim I want to make now is that this particular class of graphs is a geometrical series. And the way to think about it is the better way to think about this is not as a correction to the propagator, but it's a correction to the inverse propagator. So the thing we've calculated here, pi mu nu, you can think of it as being a correction to the thing that you're inverting to get the propagator. And that corresponds graphically to summing up these particular graphs. And so I'm telling you all that because we're going to be interested in the zeros of this quantity pi, because that's going to be telling us where the poles of this corrected propagator are. And that's going to be telling us about the masses of the particles involved in a way that I'm regretting actually probably not doing that first before doing the calculation here. But I'm going to do a tangent shortly after carrying this calculation a little bit further to make a more precise connection between the poles of the propagator and the positions of masses, the values of masses. And but this kind of, I want to give you a hand-waving argument first as to why the values of this function are going to tell us about how the poles and residues of propagators are going to change as a function of interactions. So, if we said that this whole sum was a call that whole sum g mu nu, then one way of writing it would be if I write it as a matrix notation as g is equal to g naught. Times what I'm calling pi here now, times g naught. So this is g naught. The g naughts are describing these external lines, and pi is the thing we're evaluating for just the graph without the external lines. And this graph here would be the same thing iterated. And you can kind of see that completely, you know, continuing to iterate this one loop will continue to give you things with iterations of pi in it. So the simplest thing is to say, to multiply on the left by g naught inverse, and we can multiply it on the right by g maybe. Or do you want to do that next? Let's just do that. So we have g naught inverse g is equal to 1 plus pi g naught plus pi g naught pi g naught plus so on. And what you can see is that if I take everything here now, I can factor out of all these other terms, I can factor a pi out, right? But there's a, and once I've factored a pi out, I'm left with the original series. So I could write this thing as being 1 plus pi times g naught plus g naught pi g naught. And that you recognize as being what we were calling G originally. So we can think of this as being saying that, so we know that G naught inverse is equal to times G is equal to 1 plus pi times G. So if I multiply on the right by G inverse, it says that G naught inverse will be equal to G inverse plus pi. And that shows that one way to think of this series is that the inverse propagator is equal to the zeroth order inverse propagator minus this thing we're calculating, pi. So if we had been doing scalar field theory, for example, then the thing in the Lagrangian, we would have written our Lagrangian, our free Lagrangian would have been something like, or the integral of it, d4x, would have been something like the integral of 1 half d phi squared plus m squared. I put a minus sign running around. Excuse me. And so, you know, in terms of, if I integrate this by parts, this is a minus 1 half integral d4x of phi minus box plus m squared phi. And so one way of thinking about the propagator you would have had for a scalar field would have been that it's the inverse. This is what we would have called G naught inverse, because the thing in our Gaussian integrals over here, when I'm calling A inverse, I'm now calling G naught. And so A, the thing that was in the action, would have been G naught inverse. And so this is what I called A before over there. Now you can think of it as being G naught inverse if I think of G naught being the propagator. And so the statement here would be that if you do the multiple insertions of a graph like this and add them all up, then a simple way to think about what you're doing is that you're shifting the inverse propagator, so that it's like you're adding a piece to the free non-interacting Lagrangian. So if I had told you at some point that pi at zero momentum was a constant, then it wouldn't be a big stretch to think of that as being a change to the mass, right? Is kind of one of the things where this takes you. So for gauge fields, it's a little bit more involved because there's indices mu and nu we're carrying around, but so we'll carry them around, but it's the same story. And what we should be thinking about is places where pi, if pi does not vanish in momentum space, this minus box plus m squared is what became p squared plus m squared. And so that vanishing was the condition that told us what the energies were, and that's what identified this as being the mass. The energy was the square root of the momentum squared plus the mass squared, because that was the condition that this was equal to zero, where p squared here is the four momentum squared. So the vanishing of that is the same thing as a pole for G. So if G naught inverse has a zero, then G naught has a pole there. And so we can think of the mass as being a place where, as a function of p squared, where these things are having poles. And the significance of these self-energy corrections is that we want to know whether they're vanishing or not at the place where the uncorrected piece had a pole. So if G naught inverse was vanishing at some place, that would be, so if this had been p squared plus m squared, that was what G naught inverse was, then if pi of p squared, if it happened that pi of p squared did not vanish when p squared was minus m squared, then that would be moving the position of the pole from p squared equals minus m squared to p squared equals minus m squared plus this correction, pi of minus m squared. And so these self-energies are useful for thinking about where the poles of propagators are. And I'll have to make that a little bit more precise when we come back to renormalizing things. Because what we're going to do is we want to know if we change the mass, how do all our formulas change? Okay, so that was kind of ultimately an aside, right? Because Leo has been calculating this graph and has been evaluating this quantity and has in the process, he's kind of, you know, he set up dimensional regularization when doing it, and he set up the Feynman parameter trick. And he set up for you the Wick rotation. So the conversion from momenta in Minkowski signature, like we're used to, it's convenient to do the integrals where you go to Euclidean signature. And that just makes the integrals easier to think about. And it's also a place where you are punished if you use the wrong metric, because in the Wick rotations, we have P mu, K mu. In a Minkowski signature would be minus P0, K0 plus P dot K. And so in Wick rotating from this signature to what you're doing in the complex plane is, you, instead of integrating the momenta that way, you decide to integrate them that way. And you do that because you know that the poles are all in these two quadrants, so you can rotate things in this direction sensibly without hitting any singularities. And that changes the sign here to make this thing the Euclidean dot product. And if they'd been the same vector, that would mean that, you know, P squared would become P0 squared plus P squared, which is positive if you use the right metric. But if you'd been using the wrong metric, where this is positive and this was negative, then you would have actually had a negative definite thing when you do this rotation. And even though you could tell yourself that you'll keep track of signs in your head, your mind sees a positive thing when it sees a square. And it's really hard to keep track of signs if you're using notation that fights what you think is positive or not. So one of the arguments for using the correct metric is that it makes these Wick rotation calculations easier to do. All right, so. But so Leo set these things up for you, right? So you've seen those things, and you're kind of you're good to go on them. And where I think he left off was an expression along the lines of so tell me if this is right. So where I think he left off was that he had pi mu nu as a function of I called it T, but I want to call it Q. Actually, I'll stick to P, I guess. It's equal to the tensor structure was simple. It was P squared eta mu nu minus P mu P nu. And then there's a function, an invariant function of P squared with no indices. And this invariant function was the thing that was evaluated to an integral, and it was minus 2 to the 1 plus alpha minus b over 2 b squared over 2 pi to the b over 2. Gamma of 2 minus d over 2, integral 0 to 1 dx, x, 1 minus x, m squared plus p squared over mu squared to the d over 2 minus 2. So where d is a dimensional regularization parameter, which is we're going to take it to be 4. But when we go to d equals 4, we're going to find that the things are going to diverge. So we'll take it to be 4 minus 2 epsilon, where epsilon is a parameter which is going to go to 0. But we'll have to be careful about how we take that limit. And alpha is the thing that it arose because we had to take a trace over the Dirac matrices in d dimensions. And so alpha was d over 2 if d is even, I think. And it was d minus 1 over 2 if d is odd. So it was just 2 to the alpha was the thing that counted the dimension of the Dirac matrices. And, you know, E is E. X is the Feynman parameter that was introduced originally for that. And then mu is the arbitrary scale, which in dimensional regularization enters, because when you're doing dimensional analysis for your interaction, so if we have our Lagrangian in four dimensions, you look at the interaction term here. And we also have psi bar d slash psi. So in four dimensions, you know, we know that the F mu is a mass squared, because it's the derivative of A. And so A mu has dimensions of mass. Psi has dimensions of mass to the 3/2. Right? I made this argument right the first week, right? So if I just ask for the, we know the action is it has the dimensions of h bar. So if h bar is 1, in those units the action is dimensionless. So d4x has dimensions of length to the 4th. The Lagrangian has to be mass to the 4th. And so we can read off from the kinetic terms the dimension of all the fields. And then that allows us in the interaction terms to read off the dimensions of the couplings. And so since that's mass to the 3/2, that's mass to the 3/2, this combination is mass cubed. That's mass, so this is mass to the 4th. So all the dimensions are set. So then E would be dimensionless. But that was crucial that we were doing this in four dimensions. If we'd done this in D dimensions, which is what we've done for dimensional regularization, then this has to be mass to the D. So in D dimensions, you know, a boson will be mass. Well, two bosons and two derivatives has to be mass to the D. This will be D over 2 minus 1. And the fermion, two fermions and one derivative has to be mass to the D. So this will be mass to the D minus 1 over 2. If I've done that right, so if I take D equals 4, then this will become 1, that's right, and this will become 3/2, right? So now if I go to this term and ask, what's the dimensions of E? E is going to be mass. Well, it'll be whatever I need to get mass to the D, given the dimension of these guys, right? So I've got the two fermions is going to be mass. Those two guys together are going to be mass to the D minus 1. But the gauge boson is not mass anymore. It's mass to the D over 2 minus 1. That means that E has to have dimensions of mass to the I've done something wrong here, right? So it'll have to be 2 minus D over 2, I guess. So that's right. I've got mass to D here. So if I take the E has to be basically canceling the remaining dimensions here. So it'll be mass squared minus D over 2. So the mu, so that means that this is no longer a dimensionless coupling E if we're not in four dimensions. And in particular, if we're continuing away from four dimensions by a small amount, it's useful to keep E dimensionless so we don't have high dimensions in an answer somewhere. And to write mu explicitly as being the mass scale associated with E. And so what we do is we write E as being, place E by E times mu to the 2 minus D over 2, and follow the mu around, and that's where that mu came from. You're happy with all that, right? I'm just reiterating what Leo said. So now the next thing to do is to try and go to, this is for general D, and we'd like to go to D equals 4. And you can see that the only problem with going from D equals to D equals 4 is really here. Because if D is 4, what's happening is that 4/2 is 2, and we're evaluating the gamma function at 0. And the gamma function has poles at non-negative integers, non-positive integers, sorry. So it's 0 and minus 1, minus 2, minus 3. Those are the places where it's going to be, it's going to diverge. So so all we have to do is just expose that derivative because, or that divergence, because that's the, that divergence is the reflection that our original integral was diverging. That we have something here involving four integrals over L, and we have it's going to be hard to see, but given that we had two external momenta that came out here, and we have an integral d4L, and we've got propagators that go like 1 over momenta for the two fermions, so we've got 1 over momentum squared. This looks like this should be diverging quadratically because there's 4 momenta in the numerator, 2 in the denominator, but the whole answer was proportional to 2 momenta, so that once those have been pulled out, what's left is diverging logarithmically. And so we knew that this thing had to be diverging, and the way we see the divergence in this regularization scheme is through the poles that we hit when d goes to 4. One thing I forgot to say here, which Leo might have commented on, is that this is a magic combination. That satisfies the property that p mu pi mu nu equals 0. And that's something which is a consequence of gauge invariance. That if I had, and I'll come back to that. So this is a good thing. Okay, so now this, what we should do is we should try and follow the poles. So to do that, let's just do one more step in. And morally speaking, what we have here is because we have a. In fact, let me go back to the, you know, the general form of this integral that we're doing came to us as the integral of d dp of p squared to the a. That was the integral that in dimensional regularization you did, right? And that was the thing that, this is the thing that came to, turned out to be, you know, I pi to the d over 2 m of a d over 2. Right, this is the general formula that I think Leo gave you. And all you're really using is the fact that the angular integral here you can do for free because nothing depends on, none of the external momenta depend on the angular variables in these extra dimensions beyond the 4. So the angular integral you can do once and for all. And so you get factors here coming from the volume of a sphere in n dimensions. And then the overall power of m squared, that m squared is on dimensional grounds. If I scale p squared, a factor of m squared out of p squared, then keep track of the total power that's going to be here. Look at m squared to the a plus d. Yeah, I'll get m to the 2a plus d minus 2b, which is that. And this remaining thing is coming from the remaining integral that you're doing over the modulus of p is just a beta function, right? Which is, you can write in terms of ratios of gamma functions. So I want to, a useful combination of A and B is if you'd asked how is this thing diverging, you know, the superficial, what you call the superficial degree of divergence, for this graph would have been, you know, the total number of momenta in the numerator divided by the minus and ones in the denominator, right? So it would have been, I'll call it capital D, but it would have been little d plus twice A minus twice B. So if D is negative, we're thinking this thing converges in the from the limit where p goes to infinity. If d is 0, that corresponds to it diverging logarithmically. And if d is positive, that's diverging like a power of the ultraviolet cutoff. A UV finite equals 0 would be log divergent. So you can kind of see that what I'd like to argue is that these poles are reflecting the divergences that you would have expected from the degree of divergence here. So what I'll do is I'll rewrite this factor here in terms of d. So you know b minus a minus d over 2, that's just going to be, what will that be? That'll be I divide by 2, and I'll get d over 2. Here I've got plus d over 2, and here I've got minus d over 2. Well, this is something which I could pack. I should be able to do this in my head, but I'm not going to be able to do it. So it's if I take d over 2, and what I want to do, I want to take minus that. And now that gives me this. Which also gives me minus d over 2, which is what I want. Am I really done there? That seems like I didn't really want to be that easy, but. Yeah. So. The thing that's diverging here is this particular gamma matrix is gamma of minus d over 2. And you can see that if d is negative, then gamma is being evaluated at a real positive value, so it'll be finite. If d is 0, then gamma has a pole at 0, so it'll be diverging. And if d is a positive integer, or d is an even positive integer, it's going to give you something which is also diverging. So these poles are going to be appearing when you expected the integral to be diverging if you'd just been trying to cut the integral off. And I just want to write out what the expansion is. So what we have to know is what the gamma function looks like near a zero, near a pole. So the two things you need are the expansion near zero. That's the largest pole is the one at zero. So gamma of x for x near zero, let me just quote it to you. It's 1 over x minus gamma plus order x. So gamma is the Euler Mascherelli constant. Is that how you spell it? So it's, you know, it's 0.5772157, so it's a known number. Then for all the other ones that are not at zero, we just use the fact that x times gamma of x is, you know, identically equal to gamma of x plus 1. So if we want to know, if we take x to be very small, no, what do I want to do? If I want to expand around x equals minus 1. So what I could do is I could take gamma of 1 plus x will be 1 over 1 plus x minus gamma plus order 1 plus x. If I think of 1 plus x as being small, so x is near minus 1, then so I just rewrote that with x replaced by 1 plus x. If I now use this, then if I divide by x, and what I need to do is take this x and write it in a series. You know, so if I write x is equal to 1 plus x minus 1, and I just need to do the Taylor expansion to write the series and powers of 1 plus x. So this will be the first term here. We'll just, x will be, if 1 plus x is small, then that means x is minus 1. So this will be minus 1 over 1 plus x. And we'll get minus gamma plus 1, I think. If I do the expansion here, I'm going to have, an overall plus 1 plus gamma minus 1 with order. Did I do that right? Check that. Yes. That was great. So that shows you how the what the pole looks like near minus 1, and you can just iterate this process to get the pole near minus 2 or minus 3. Yeah. From where? From this? Because I'm expanding in powers of this being small. I'm doing it, I'm looking at the expansion near x equals minus 1. So I'm writing this as, so x is minus 1 plus a small thing, and so then I'm Taylor expanding everything out. And the main pole term is just change the sign every, you know, so it would, if we did it around x plus 2, would be plus 1 over x plus 2, and so on. So the spirit of the things that we're calculating is, for this integrals, is we've got some function of d times this particular gamma matrix, which is diverging. And so, I of d is some function of d times this gamma of minus d over 2. And so that's the best way to write this. So this we know is something which is diverging. In the cases where capital D is 0 or negative, it's something which is, this is vanishing. This argument is either vanishing or it's a negative integer. And so this factor is going to have a term which will be, you know, it'll be basically plus or minus 1, because it'll depend, that plus or minus 1 will depend if this is vanishing, then it'll be plus 1. If it's a gamma of minus 1 we're evaluating at, it'll be minus 1. If we're evaluating it if the pole is at, you know, minus 2, it'll be plus 1. So we'll have divided by plus some number, C order. That's what that factor is. This factor, it's something which is finite when d went to 4. But because of this pole, we have to keep not just that finite piece, so it'll have something f of 4, but there will also be a d over 2 minus 1 times f prime of 4, and so on. So there's some expansion you could do of this thing in powers of d minus 4. That should be 2, sorry. And you can kind of see that when you multiply this out, what will happen is that this thing will see this thing and give you the overall pole. So you get something like plus or minus f of 4 over d over 2 minus 2. Then you're going to get pieces which are come from this thing hitting the finite piece. So you get f of 4 times c. But also you get this piece hitting the pole. And so you'll get plus or minus f plus 4. And then you'll get things that are vanishing as d goes to 4. Order. So in this expression over here, things are going to simplify a lot because we basically have something, here's our pole, and it's a pole which is happening at gamma of zero, the singularity, where as d goes to 4, this argument is going to 0. And then there's various d's that are elsewhere. There's a d here, and there's d's in these powers here. But all we need to do is to follow those things out to a few orders in the expansion around d equals 4, and then forget everything else because we're going to take d equals 4 at the end. And there will be a pole term, which we'll have to follow. There'll be some finite term, which we'll have to follow, which will involve the, part of it will involve the functions evaluated at 4 dimensions, but also there'll be a piece which comes from following the, the d-dependence, differentiating the d-dependence of these coefficients. And but then we can stop. All right, so if we do that, then this is what you get. Where's the brush? All right, so we have, so all I'm going to write is the, I'm not keeping track of this factor, I'm just writing this thing without the indices now. I'm just writing this formula here, expanding it out. So look at pi, p squared, and d is minus e squared over 12 pi squared. So if I've now put in the value d equals 4, for the pole part, everything else could be evaluated at 4 dimensions. So I got e squared over 4 pi squared, 1 over 2 minus d over 2. And there's plus e squared over 2 pi squared, our Euler constant divided by 6. That simplified a fair bit because the when d was equal to 4, this whole integrand became stupid, right? There was no p squared any left. So this just became some number, and in this integral you could do explicitly. And so there was the only thing involving an x integral here is coming from the place where you're expanding this thing, and you're picking off the derivative with respect to d here. So you're picking off this term. And that's why you're getting a logarithm as well. Is that it's the derivative of this kind of a power is going to be a logarithm of the argument. So that shows you that there's a divergence. Is one thing. It isolates the divergence. So there's your divergence. But it shows you in particular that the divergence is actually only an overall constant, an additive constant. So. If you like, if I evaluate it at p squared equals 0, then if p squared 0, then I kill the x dependence in this logarithm, then again, the integral I can do fairly straightforwardly. So this would have been minus p squared over 12 pi squared. Whereas if I take pi of p squared minus pi of p squared equals 0, this difference is always finite. Let's just call that pi finite of p squared. That'll be 2e squared over. So all the dependence on mu, this arbitrary dimensional regularization scale, is in the piece which is also divergent. And this finite thing doesn't depend on anything ambiguous at all. It depends only on the mass and then on p squared. And it's the thing that is really the physical thing here. So these are the kind of the two main things we want to work with the next little while. And the things we want to ask are, you know, so what do you do with the divergence? And what's the physical significance of the what's left? And so the part about doing what do you do with the divergence, that's the whole story about renormalization. And so what I want to do is show you that that the this divergence is something which we're going to be able to absorb into the normalization of one of the fields. Morally speaking, what's happened is that you know, I was giving you a song and dance up here that that we've shifted the inverse propagator by pi. And so we've effectively added a divergent piece to the what was the free Lagrangian. But the free Lagrangian for the gauge field was, you know, it was minus 1/4 f mu nu, f mu nu. If I wrote that, you know, that was in position space. If I wrote that in momentum space, that would have been something like, you know, a mu p squared eta mu nu minus p mu p nu times a nu, and it would have had this particular tensor form because that's the expression of gauge invariance. That this was designed to be invariant under a mu goes to a mu plus derivative of something. So in momentum space, that would correspond to a mu goes to a mu plus p mu times some variable. And this was the combination that satisfied that p mu contracted with it was zero, right? So this is the thing, this combination is the kind of thing that is appearing in the action because of gauge invariance. So what we found by finding that the self-energy has this tensor structure is that we're effectively adding a piece to the inverse propagator. So it's like adding a piece to the Lagrangian, which has the same kind of tensor structure as the Lagrangian originally did anyway. So it has this kind of this tensor structure. And this pi is like changing the normalization of this whole thing. So we have this 1/4 here, which would have been a half if I wrote it in terms of the a's here. And so you remember that we originally could have started off with, we wouldn't have started off with 1/4, we would have had minus some numbers, z over 2 or z over 4. And we rescaled the fields to make z equals 1. And effectively, one way to think about the pi of 0, so the momentum independent piece of pi, is that that's like a number in front of this kinetic term that we've added now, which we're free to remove by a field redefinition in the same way that we would have gotten rid of this thing. And so that's where this thing is going to go. We're going to absorb this constant into a field redefinition, which is essentially something we were doing anyway, but we now have to redo because even if we had assumed that we'd canonically normalized the kinetic term before, these quantum corrections, these loops, are now unnormalizing it for us, and so we have to go back and then renormalize it. That's the origin of the word renormalization. And so that's the first statement, is that we're going to be able to stick this divergence into a, we're going to be able to absorb it into a redefinition of the fields, and then it's going to be gone from physical things that we calculate. And so then, but to make that case, what I'm going to need to do is so this is how it's working for the gauge fields, but there's also what's happening with the electron field. And so how many parameters do we have to renormalize? And we'll need to make a list. And so what we're going to want to do in the next few lectures will be to is to repeat this kind of argument, say that if we had done a general graph and we asked how it was diverging, kind of like we did here, what was the degree of divergence? Which graphs diverge? So how many kinds of things are you going to need the freedom to absorb divergence into? And you'll see that the special thing about quantum electrodynamics is that it's one of those theories where you only get these divergences where you had a parameter in the Lagrangian to absorb it. So that's the first case we'll make. Once we've finished all that, then we'll come back to this finite part, because this is the one that has a lot of the physics in it. And so the physical interpretation of this thing is that if we take a charge, this is called the vacuum polarization. It's called polarization for a reason. If you stick a charge in the vacuum and you ask what are the electromagnetic fields it sets up, then the electromagnetic fields it sets up are really literally what you would have expected from a polarizable medium. If you have a polarizable medium, you stick a charge and the medium polarizes, right? The positive and negative charges that can be polarized start to separate from each other. And so if you put in a negative charge, it attracts the positive end of the polarizability, and so that the charge partially gets screened out by the positive side of the charges that can polarize. And so what happens is you're kind of distorting the charge distribution out a little bit. You're not changing the net charge, because a polarizable medium is neutral. It's made of charge pairs that can separate, but they're not separating arbitrarily, so you don't get a net charge from them. But if you look at the charge close up, and then you look at it farther back, you may or may not include some of these polarized charges. And so the charge that you see in a particular size is going to change as a function of size. And the vacuum behaves very, very much like that. That's what this says. It says that virtual electron-positron pairs, which is what our graph originally was, you know, this electric field, electron-positron, these things are essentially polarizing in response to the presence of charges. So I'm going to write this in position space, and you'll see that you can write it literally as a polarizable medium with a charge distribution that you can explicitly write out, because it's the Fourier transform of this function, basically. And that's the origin you'll see that the signs are such that these electrons are the virtual electrons and positrons are tending to screen charges at small distances. And that gives you a physical interpretation for what this vacuum polarization means. And if you stick that into the, you know, energy levels of things like the hydrogen atom, that's one of the contributions to the Lamb shift. It's not the largest one, but it's one. And it's in position space, it's easiest to do that. So that's where I'd like to go. There's going to be two big detours. One will be renormalizability. So how do graphs diverge in general? And how do you absorb the divergences that you find in terms of parameters of Lagrangian? And that second step is going to involve making this kind of hand-wavy argument better. Here I kind of made this relationship between the propagator and the inverse propagator based on summing a class of graphs, but why that class of graphs is not something else. So what we're looking for then is a kind of a more general statement that says that the poles and residues of propagators are related to masses and normalizations of fields. And so the two detours will be on the divergences, and then on what's called the Lehmann-Chalain representation, which is the thing that tells you as an exact statement that propagators, the poles and residues of propagators are to do with the normalizations of fields and the values of their masses. But for which this summation argument, it captures the right physics. And then we'll come back. So those will be detours, and then when we finish the detours, we'll come back to these formulas again. So don't forget those formulas. Any questions about that? That's probably a natural place to break now, because it's 11. But I'm going to start next time with taking a general graph with arbitrary numbers of external lines, arbitrary kinds of internal lines and vertices, and asking under what circumstances does it diverge? And which kinds of theories would you expect to have nice things happen where you can absorb the divergences into the parameters of the Lagrangian? And which kinds of theories would you not expect that to happen? And you'll see that they divide in a very nice way, which essentially will come down to the dimensions of the coupling constants in the theory. So if you have the assignment, hand it in. If you want to wait till Friday, that's also okay. Okay, so it's...